Am I supposed to be talking?
Yes, you are.
I don't know.
Maybe there's a jingle or something.
There is. There's the one that goes, Plan B with Rebecca Davis. I've done it now, so we don't have to do that again. So today, I think, in fact, probably as we speak, Babsi Nobanda is arriving home from Thailand.
I watched the visuals on ENCA. Already home. No dreadlocks.
No dreadlocks. Not a shock there.
For those listeners who don't know, just give a little bit of the background to the story.
Babsi Nobanda was the 23-year-old Grahamstown girl, Makhanda girl, who in December 2011 was caught trafficking 1.5 kilograms of cocaine into Thailand. Street value 1.2 million. She had been promised 16,000 rand for her job. And she claims that she never had any idea she was signing up to smuggle cocaine. She says that she was recruited by a friend. They were told they would be selling Brazilian hair products into South Africa. So they were taken to Brazil, and it was there that they were told, whoops, you've actually signed up to take drugs to Thailand, so get
busy. And you originally wrote about the story in 2012.
I was really intrigued by it because so much of it struck me as hugely unjust. And one of the things was that apparently, well, Babsi claims in a confession she gave to the Thai government that she could not and would not swallow the condoms filled with drugs in Brazil that her Nigerian handlers were asking her to. And the research of other journalists like Hazel Friedman, who's done a lot of work on South African drug mules, suggests that this is basically your death warrant as a drug mule. If you won't swallow the condoms, you will be used as a decoy to make sure that other smugglers get through safely. And that's exactly what happened to Babsi. She walked in tottering, we might recall from that awful footage of the time, tottering under the weight of this cocaine sewn very badly into her dreadlocks. And she says immigration officials came straight for her. So they were obviously tipped off in advance. And her friend, who had been also carrying drugs, was allowed to slip through undetected. And that's how it works. They put the syndicates pick you out as a decoy, you get taken down, and the real drug smugglers go through. And one of the things was that case really drew attention to this problem that South Africa has no, what's the technical term? The technical term is interstate prisoner transfer agreements, right? With any country. And if it did, what that would have meant is that when Babsi Nobanda was sentenced to originally 30 years, then 15 years in prison, she would have been
and
able...
And a massive fine as well.
And a massive fine, 250,000 rand. She would have been able to come back to South Africa and serve it out at a correctional facility near her family. But South Africa won't do that. And as a result, you know, there's been lobbying from these anguished parents in particular in South Africa whose kids have been dragged into this world of drug trafficking and are now languishing in these jails in Thailand, in China, in Malaysia.
Do we know any of what she's gone through over the last 8 years?
We don't know what she's gone through, but we know a lot about that particular prison. It's called the big women's prison in Bangkok. That is where Vanessa Huisin was kept, South African former beauty queen. Shani Krebs, another high-profile drug mule who was also in one of those prisons. And we know conditions are appalling and that you have to pay for everything. That there's no, you know, you pay for food, you pay for space, that if your family doesn't have money, that's what Vanessa Huisin said, you're going to be in trouble. So the conditions are appalling, even by the standards of South Africans' own terrible jails. And the question is, why won't South Africa sign these treaties? The government has been discussing it since 2004, but their defense has been, it's too expensive. If we have to bring these guys home and keep them here, then it costs us money. But the point is, there are many more foreigners in South African jails than there are South Africans in foreign jails, about seven times as many, apparently. So if we sign those treaties, we could also kick all the criminals back to their countries to serve out their terms in jail.
It's a win-win.
It is totally a win-win. And in the the interest of, you know, humanitarian concerns, this really needs to be something that's expedited. And I really hope that Babsi Nobanda, though, God bless, I hope she just kicks back in Makhanda and relaxes. I also hope that she will at some point use her voice to advocate for this change in law.
I'm sure that there are many news organizations also clamoring for that first interview with her. And then the political response to the Am I Next movement, Marianne Merton wrote a piece in the Daily Maverick today, basically talking about how, she's been covering Parliament for years. She knows how it works, but she's talking about Cyril's 5-point whatever plan, saying it's all a PR stunt. We shouldn't get too excited. It's rather lackluster.
Yeah, that it's mainly rehashed proposals, that there's many practical things that they could have been following on up on all along, sexual offences courts, to deserve care centres. Those just haven't been allowed. So the response from politicians, as always, has been kind of enraging. But to me, Mel, by far, the next league of enraging has been the Freedom Front Plus's response. Oh, this started when the Am I Next movement first sort of got off the ground with the murder of Nene, etc., when they put out their first media statement about this, in which they stated, and they have now stated this twice, that, quote, the lack of mutual respect and discipline is the root cause of gender violence in South Africa. This is the Freedom Front Plus's hot take on the scourge of gender violence. It is a problem of a mutual lack of respect. Now, I'm allowing for the fact that English genuinely is not the first language of the people drafting these statements, but even so, can we just think about what they are saying there? Freedom Front Plus is saying that women are beaten and killed and raped in this
because
country.
They're not showing enough respect.
At least partly because they don't show enough respect to men. That is not just, I mean, it's not just insane, because it clearly is, but it's also
dangerous.
It's dangerous. It's everything. Yeah. And then what they've also done is to try to shoehorn in their own concerns about Afrikaans and the persecution of white people. So yesterday in Parliament, there was the debate. Freedom Front Plus gets up and says, you know, gender violence is one side of the coin. The other is, why are we persecuting white people? Why are we not upholding the rights of Afrikaners through their own interest
group? How are white people being persecuted?
Afrikaans universities, all that vibe. The point is, come on, Freedom Front Plus. Come on, we understand that you are a political party who's unashamed about lobbying for the rights of Afrikaans speakers, for white people, for brown people. That's fine. It's a constitutional right, good for you. But please, give us a moment to focus on gender violence without trying to sully it with your other issues. And please do not tell women that they are becoming the victims of violence for not showing enough respect.
Who was it who stood up in Parliament?
Pieter Marais. Was it Pieter Marais? It was Peter Groenewald, I think. There's so many Peters in that party. One of the Peters. And it has been the party line. That is the official party line on this matter.
I'm speechless.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Let's move on to wardrobing.
Wardrobing? Have you ever heard that term?
I'm ashamed to say that I do know what it is.
Mel.
Wardrobing, the act of taking a piece of clothing, wearing it, and then taking it back to the shop.
Yeah, right. I didn't know that that's the actual
I've done it
term.
Once. I have done it once in my 20s where I had, and can I tell you, I will never, ever do it again, because returning that item of clothing, I was the guilt,
sweating.
The sweat and shame and guilt. And I honestly felt like police officers were going to jump out of the clothing racks and arrest me right then and there. And I did not breathe again until I was all the way out of the parking lot.
Where had you worn this outfit to before?
I'd worn it to a big function and I didn't. You know, in your 20s, you don't have a... But I still feel the shame. Like even now, if I buy something and I have the right to return it, I don't, because the shame lives with me even now, 15 years later.
Well, you are one of many, Mel, although you're very honest to admit it. Apparently now, 1 in 5 UK people in the UK admit to doing this, to buying an item, which is not always clothes, by the way, using it once for a specific purpose and then returning it for a full refund. It's mainly clothes, and it's costing retailers billions a year. But also apparently it's things like power tools. So you need to drill a hole in your wall, go there by the hardware store for Black & Decker, buy a drill. Drill your holes, come back, no, not for me, and you get your refund. I'm wondering if your listeners will admit to ever having done this.
I hope they do join me in the walk of shame.
In the walk of shame.
I really do. I mean, Nicola was telling me a story about people, I don't know whether she knows, but they bought camping equipment, went on a 2-week camping trip, then made sure it was very clean and whatever, and then returned it at the end.
Wow, that is next level camping equipment.
Camping.
I mean, you must seriously have to give that one a good scrub before you bring it back to the shelf.
And one wonders what kind of items, I mean, besides power tools and clothes, have taken and returned. I'd love to know.
I had the opposite the other day where I legitimately purchased something from Cotton On, and I got home and I realized they hadn't taken off that big plastic
black you can't get those
tag
things
that
off.
You can't get off by yourself. But I'd thrown away the receipt because I knew I wanted to keep this item. So then I had to go back to the shop the next day and say, I promise I bought this, but your cashier didn't remove the tag. And I was like, who would believe that? They did. They were immediately like, oh, sorry, it happens all the time. They took it off, which also made me think, if you ever want to steal something, maybe that's the way to do it. But anywho, moving swiftly on.
Rebecca's not going to be continue giving her tips for shoplifting. We are going to talk about her podcast series after an update on what's happening on the roads. And we're continuing our conversation with Rebecca Davis. And EWN is launching an incredible podcast series about the Boer Kaap ahead of Heritage Day, produced by Rebecca Davis and Haji Muhammad Dawood. It's a three-part series.
It is.
And it focuses on the Boer Kaap and gentrification. Take us through a little bit of...
Well, you know, the Boer Kaap is a fascinating area. And obviously it's become kind of the epicenter of this debate about gentrification and how to do gentrification, whether there is any way to do it in a non-offensive manner. But what I didn't realize going into the podcast as well is that actually the history of the Boer Kaap is much more nuanced and complicated.
And loaded with myths.
Loaded with myths. Let me give you an example, if I might. So the first episode of the podcast, I should say, focuses on the history of the Boer Kaap and looks at some of the myths involved. I don't know if we have a clip.
We have a clip.
So here's one of the most prevalent and hardest to shift myths about the Boer Kaap, that most of its unique character stems from the fact that it has been an Islamic enclave since its establishment over 200 years ago. And this was a claim I found literally all over, including in well-respected academic journals.
Okay, but hang on. You're surely not disputing that the character of the Boer Kaap is basically Muslim. There are 10 mosques there, 5 Muslim burial grounds. And as a Muslim myself, I was definitely taught that the oldest mosque in South Africa was built in the Boer Kaap. So you're surely not claiming that, you know, it has no Islamic presence, which stretches back centuries.
No, no, everything you've just said is true. But what is not true is the idea that the Boer Kaap was always only home to Muslims, or even to only so-called colored people. So the foremost historian of the Boer Kaap was this amazing guy called Dr. Ahmad Davids. He was a Boer Kaap local, sadly passed away in 2012. This year he was awarded one of the country's top national honors, which is pretty cool. What Dr. Davids did was painstakingly go through the archival street records to find out who the inhabitants of Boer Kaap were in time gone by.
And what did he find?
The first houses in Boer Kaap, they were built for rent in the 1780s by this Dutch guy, Jan de Waal. He worked for the Dutch East India Company. So they were initially occupied by both white immigrants who worked in town and by the Mardijkers, who were free Muslims brought to the Cape for their skills and never enslaved. So slavery is abolished in Cape Town by the British in 1834, and the former slaves move from the slave lodge in town, where obviously they were effectively imprisoned, to the area above Badenkrocht Street. And many of those former slaves were Muslim. But actually, Boer Kaap becomes this vibrant, diverse community, which was racially mixed until well into the 20th century.
That's episode one. You look at the challenges facing residents in that community and how some long-time residents have been forced to move out. And
yes,
you look at the more recent protests.
That's right. So in episode two, we go into a bit about those great legacy businesses in Boer Kaap, you know, the Atlas trading, Roxol trading, these businesses that have been there in some cases since the 19th century and in many cases are being forced out by these, you know, kind of yuppified businesses. You can buy vegan ice cream in the Boer Kaap now. You can do yoga on a rooftop. And the question of to what degree those new practices are in keeping with the Boer Kaap's original character is really, well, it's up for debate, I think. Let's see if we have a clip from the second episode.
But the narrative that Boer Kaap remained completely untouched by the Group Areas Act is a myth, which we've discussed in episode one. The area did suffer the consequences as much as any other community of color. In fact, a more appropriate way to describe it would be to say that Boer Kaap underwent a cultural cleansing during the Group Areas Act, with only those classified as Cape Malay allowed to remain, and all other inhabitants were sent elsewhere. Here's Mr. Jaga.
From the 40s, 50s onwards, when the people were moved from the area, and those that were fortunate, they remained. But then of course, they wanted to move out the African people who used to be in the city area as well. There used to be white people also staying in the area, and they managed to get them out of the area. And also, there wasn't a very big population of Indians, but they tried to get us out from here. And we, together with some other business people in the area, we managed to secure ourselves in this respect. We went to the department and told them, look, this is our livelihood. You can't uproot us as far as our livelihood is concerned. And he said, well, in that case, then you'll have to stay on permit. And of course, every second year, third year, we had to go and apply for a permit.
So that's one of the other fascinating things about Boer Kop, Mel. There's this sense that now the Boer Kop is under unique threat, that it's never before been the case that people were trying to be pushed out of Boer Kop. Very much not the case. Boer Kop was the site of forced removals during apartheid in the Group Areas Act. A lot of people think for some reason it was this kind of untouched area. It wasn't. And as the business owner there is discussing, there was an attempt to drive out a lot of businesses at the time, well before gentrification, on the basis of the race of the business owners. So there's a lot to unpack. We hope that the three-part podcast does that, and it is available, I think, on Apple Podcasts as well as the Cape Talk website.
It's being released ahead of Heritage Day. So
that's right.
So on Monday, Tuesday, we're not...
It's definitely available from next week, I'm pretty sure.
Today? Nicholas, and today, fantastic. You can start today. Listening to that podcast series from today.
Brilliant. And I think that, you know, even for those of us who think we know Boer Kop well, I mean, it's this area that's right there in the center of town. I think you will find that there are many aspects of it that we could all do with understanding a bit more about.
And you, I mean, you, one of the stories that you talk about, you went on a tour with an official guide.
I went on one of those walking tours you see all the time going around Central Cape Town, which goes up to Boer Kop, because I wanted to see how accurate the version of history was that they were feeding to tourists. And it wasn't totally off, but there were many myths that were being perpetrated. The other one, of course, is about the painting of the Boer Kop houses. You know, this is one of the biggest things. People think that the Boer Kop houses have already always been painted there, those bright colors. It's impossible. They didn't have paint technology. People didn't have money for paint until very, very recently. So we discovered this probably only since 80s. Earliest that those brightly colored houses in the Boer Kop came into effect.
But you're right. I did a story during the protest where I interviewed one of the Boer Kop's oldest residents, 92-year-old Abdia Da Costa, and who's been living in the same house since the day she was born. But the more time you spend in the Boer Kop, the more you see the layers and the complexity.
There's a lot of, you know, tension within that community as well. You know, it's absolutely not this homogenous group of people. It's like everywhere in South Africa, it's this very vibrant and complicated and dynamic atmosphere up there by the Boer Kop.
Rebecca Davis, thank you very much.
Thanks,
that
Mel.
Podcast series starting from today, put together by Rebecca and Haji Muhammad Darwood.